It's 9:01, almost 9:02, and you are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM in Portland. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from St. John Books, North Portland's full-service independent bookstore, offering new and used books on progressive politics, literature, poetry, titles for kids, and more. St. John's Books is located at 8622 North Lombard, St. John's. Information at 503-283-0032. Or via email at info@stjohnbooks.com. And
this program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Cotton Cloud Futons, a locally owned business featuring futons and mattresses, frames, covers, furnishings, and accessories which can be made with organic and recycled materials. Cotton Cloud is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Information at 503-335-0758 or cottoncloudfutons.com.
Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday Radio Zine. Coming up first on the program, in just a minute, we'll have Between the Covers. On it, host Jim Schumach interviews Sarah Waters, author of The Night Watch, a suspense novel set in World War II London. At 9:30, Rabia Yemin interviews Liz Pearl, longtime editor and publisher, talking about her book, Money, a Memoir, Women, Missions, and Cash. 10, environmental journalist Elizabeth Grossman discusses her book, High Trash, which examines the dark side of where computers and other electronic equipment comes from and where they go when they're done, when you're done with them. And the interviewer will be Bruce Silverman. At 10:30, on a special edition of Stage and Studio, hear about the experiences and contributions of Southeast Asian refugees who came to Portland after the U.S. withdrawal from Vietnam in 1975. And at 11, on Democracy Now!, Brian Ross, chief investigative reporter at ABC News, discusses an ABC report that the government is now tracking phone calls made by journalists from the New York Times, the Washington Post, and ABC News. Also, a look at the militarization of the border with Mexico and a feature on CorpWatch's new report, Hurricane Halliburton, Conflict, Climate Change, and Catastrophe.
This is Between the Covers. I'm Jim Schumach, and welcome. My guest today is novelist Sarah Waters. Born in Wales in 1966, she is the author of four novels, Tipping the Velvet, Affinity, Fingersmith, a book that was shortlisted for the Booker Prize, and currently The Night Watch, just published by Riverhead Books. Welcome to Between the Covers, Sarah.
Thank you.
Do you remember the first book whose world totally involved you and drew you into it?
It's funny in a way, because I don't have those classic childhood reading memories. I read a lot of quite rubbishy books, really, when I think back. I never read the children's classics. I never read Enid Blyton. I don't know what the American equivalent is, but, you know, I never read Winnie the Pooh, and I had nobody to direct me to those books, really. So I read bits and pieces. I read sci-fi, and I read horror stories. I was a very macabre kind of child, and I was very keen on ghosts and horror stories. So actually, if I do remember sort of excitement, reading experiences from my childhood, it was probably over individual ghost stories like The Monkey's Paw, you know, the W.W. Jacobs story, which is still a kind of favourite classic story of mine, and a very spooky story. So it was sort of moments like that that I recall, really.
What about during your coming of age? What became critical to you then,
yeah,
and what led you places?
Well, I got, you know, I was a big reader as a child, and then, of course, once I began to know about the, you know, what books were in the world as a, through doing English at school. You know, I really enjoyed school, and I particularly enjoyed English at school, and I had some good English teachers. You know, I then began to read, say, 19th century fiction. Thomas Hardy, I really was a big Hardy fan. The Brontes, Catcher in the Rye, you know, a teacher gave me at exactly the right age. I mean, it was a fantastic novel for me at that age. So it was when I was, I guess, kind of 15, 16, 17 that I really started to read more seriously, you know, and to begin to be able to place books in a tradition. I was interested in, and to become interested in sort of doing that. So, you know, I think, as a child, I had written stories and enjoyed it very much, but my creative writing impulses became much more channeled into sort of academic writing as a teenager, studying English at A-level and then going on to university. I mean, that's where all my kind of writing energies went at that point.
What about your coming out? When did that occur, and were there any books or people involved in that?
Well, it depends what you mean by coming out, really, because I went, as a teenager, I had boyfriends, although a couple of whom later came out as gay, so I mean, it's that kind of classic queer teenage thing in a way. But then I went to college and met a girl and fell in love with a girl and had a relationship with her that then lasted 6 years, but to begin with, it was a kind of closety, you know, it was a pretty secret relationship. We were in a shared house, but we didn't come out to that stage. And so there were books and novels. I remember she bought me Patience of Sarah, an Isabel Miller novel, which is a wonderful historical about, you know, set in the mid-19th century in rural America, about two women coming together and falling in love and setting up home together. And I remember that as, you know, a really, just a big impact on me, really, as a patient. There's this very, very sort of smart, a self in love, I suppose, something I wasn't necessarily seeing elsewhere. And then once my girlfriend and I moved to London and did come out and did get into sort of lesbian feminist community, and this would have been in sort of late 80s, that was a time when there was actually quite an explosion in lesbian publishing, both in America and in the UK. And, you know, I was reading an awful lot of lesbian fiction at that time, which felt very exciting, even if the fiction itself wasn't necessarily kind of terribly ambitious or particularly kind of highbrow. You know, there was a lot of lesbian sci-fi around, so actually some of which was really thoughtful. A lot of lesbian detective, you know, kind of genre fiction, all, you know, romances, and it was just fantastically exciting that it was there at all. You know, that's my memory of it. Things kind of changed, I think, with somebody like Jeanette Winterson, who I remember reading Orange Is Not the Only Fruit, and then The Passion. I remember finding The Passion when I was doing my MA, actually, so that was in like 88, and just being really blown away by it, because, you know, here was a novel with a, you know, an unapologetic lesbian agenda, but a novel that was exciting and ambitious and literary, you know, and that felt unique, actually. That's Jeanette Winterson just seemed to come from nowhere, really, I think.
You've written a lot about Victorian England. Did having Oscar Wilde as a literary predecessor affect you in any way?
Not really, no. I mean, I did a PhD thesis after I finished first degree. I had a few years working in libraries and bookshops, and then I went to college to do a PhD. And I looked at Spinning Gay Writing from the late 19th century onwards. So I see Luke Wilde, and I was aware of him, you know. But I was, you know, he was a great role model for gay men, I think. But, you know, I was sort of looking for other stuff in a way. I was looking for a lesbian tradition. So if anybody, I think I, you know, I was looking more at people like René Vivien. Sort of a model for a character in The Night Watch called Duncan, who's a working class character. Denton Walsh was pretty well off, but I, you know, is a similar sort of introspective figure who has one experience in his youth that kind of sets him down this slightly odd path. So yeah, I definitely had Denton Walsh in mind when I was writing about Duncan.
Ellen Hollinghurst wrote a bit about the wars in the swimming pool library, and he did a wonderful job on it. He won the Booker for what I feel is a lesser book, and it strikes me that oftentimes the Booker does go to lesser novels by important writers.
Yes, it does seem to, doesn't it? You're talking about Line of Beauty, that's the one that won the Booker, isn't it, which I've just read, and which I enjoyed a lot.
I liked it too, but not as well as this one.
No, I have to say, I've read The Swimming Pool Library twice, and just, you know, I just adored it. And so he managed to do something in The Swimming Pool Library, which was to have essentially unlikable characters, and yet it was, you know, you still liked the book. Whereas with The Line of Beauty, I found the characters really, you know, so repellent. It was kind of touch and go whether I could really, you know, feel affection for the book. So, But yes, the book, I mean, prizes are an odd thing. You know, I've been on prize judging panels myself, and I know that, you know, you have a group of people talking about books, they're never necessarily going to agree. You know, some people feel passionate about one book, others feel passionate about another. Often it's the book that nobody feels that passionate about, you know, but everybody likes that gets the prize. Or I think you're right that, you know, there's a figure who you know is a great writer. Perhaps this book isn't their best, but nevertheless, you're kind of happy to give them the prize. So there's all sorts of things go on with prizes.
True of Ian McEwan's win, too, as far as I'm concerned.
For Amsterdam.
Yes, one of his least well-written books, as far as I'm concerned.
I haven't read it, but I actually remember the judges saying when they gave him the prize, "We don't think this is your best book," which is a bit of a backhanded compliment, really, isn't it?
It is. Mm. Why don't you open up the basic story you tell in The Night Watch for our listeners, if you would, and then give us a reading from early on.
Yeah, sure. Well, The Night Watch opens in 1947, just after the war, which was the setting that I initially went to. But we meet a group of characters, four main characters, Duncan, who I've mentioned, Helen, Kay, and Viv. And they're all rather tired characters. You know, they're living in a tired city, a city that's sort of still reeling from war. They're all characters who have pasts, just again as the city has this extraordinary past it's just been through. And they all have secrets, and we don't necessarily know what those secrets are, obviously. The novel then moves back in time into 1944 and so ultimately to 1941. And the movement of a novel sort of follows them back and unpeels their stories and sort of reveals their own secrets and the connections between them that aren't kind of clear to us at the start.
For those of you who may have just joined us, this is Jim Schumach with Between the Covers. My guest today, novelist Sarah Waters, and she'll be reading from her new novel, The Night Watch.
Okay, so this is from near the start of the book, really, and here two characters, Helen and Julia, who are a couple, have gone for a picnic in Regent's Park. And we already know, I think, that Helen's rather jealous. She's kind of plagued with jealousy. And at this point, they've met a woman called Ursula, who works for the BBC and has been promoting Julia, who's a writer. And Helen's feeling rather edgy, really, about the whole thing. She's just discovered that Ursula has been round to their flat without her knowing it. Julia said, "Ursula called round one day last week. Surely I told you, Helen." "I must have forgotten," said Helen. "I wanted to take a peek," said Ursula, "at Julia's study. It's always so fascinating, I think, seeing where writers do their work. Though I'm not sure whether I really envy you, Helen. I don't know how I'd feel having my friend scribbling away over my head, working out the best way to dispatch her next victim by poison or the rope." She said the word "friend," Helen thought, in a special sort of way, as if to say, "We understand one another, of course." As if to say, in fact, "We're all friends together." She had taken off her gloves to bring out a silver cigarette case from her pocket, and as she opened the case up, Helen saw her short, manicured nails and the discreet little signet ring on the smallest finger of her left hand. She held the cigarettes out. Helen shook her head. Julia, however, moved forward, and she and Ursula spent a moment fussing with a lighter, for a breeze had risen and kept blowing out the flame. They spoke further about Armchair Detective and the Radio Times, about the BBC and Ursula's job there. Then, "Well, my dears," said Ursula when her cigarette was finished, "I must be off. It's been so nice. You must both come over sometime to Clapham. You must come for supper, or better still, I could put together a bit of a party." Her gaze grew mischievous again. "We could make it an all-girl thing. What do you say?" "But of course we'd love to," said Julia when Helen said nothing. Ursula beamed. "That's settled then. I'll let you know." She took Julia's hand and playfully shook it. "I've one or two friends who would be thrilled to meet you, Julia. They're such fans." She started putting on her gloves and turned to Helen again. "Goodbye, Helen. It's been so nice to meet you properly." "Well," said Julia, as she sat back down. She was watching Ursula making her quick, smart way across the park in the direction of Portland Place. "Yes," said Helen rather thinly. "Amusing, isn't she?" "I suppose so," said Helen. "Of course, she's more your class than mine." Julia looked round, laughing. "What's that supposed to mean?" "She's a bit hearty, is all I meant. When did you take her to the house?" "Just last week," said Julia. "I told you, Helen." "Did you? You don't think I did it in secret?" "No," said Helen quickly. "No. It was only for a minute." "She's not how I imagined," said Helen. "I thought you told me she was married." "She is married. Her husband's a barrister. They live apart." "I didn't know she was, well," Helen lowered her voice, "like us." Julia shrugged. "I don't know what she is, really. A bit of an oddity, I think. Still, that party might be fun." Helen looked at her. You wouldn't want to go, really. Yes, why not? I thought you were just being polite, an all-girls thing. You know what that means. She looked down, her colour rising slightly. Anyone might be there. Julia didn't answer for a moment. When she spoke, she sounded impatient or annoyed. Well, what if they are? It won't kill us. It might even be fun. Imagine that. It'll certainly be fun for Ursula Waring anyway, said Helen, before she could stop herself. Having you there like some sort of prize pig. Julia was watching her. She said coldly, what's the matter with you? And then, when Helen wouldn't answer, it's not... Oh, no. She began to laugh. Not really, Helen. Not because of Ursula. Helen moved away. No, she said, and she lay back down with a sharp, graceless movement. She put her arm across her eyes to keep off the sun and Julia's gaze. After a moment, she felt Julia lie down too. She must have reached into the bag and brought out her book. Helen heard her leafing through its pages, looking for her place. But what Helen could see in the shifting blood-coloured depths of her own eyelids was Ursula Waring's mischievous dark gaze. She saw the way that Ursula and Julia had stood together, lighting their cigarettes. She saw again Ursula playfully shaking Julia's hand. Then she thought back. She remembered how keen Julia had been to get to the park. Come on, come quick, her fingers slipping away from Helen's in her impatience. Was it Ursula she'd wanted to see? Was it? Had they arranged the whole thing? Her heart beat faster. 10 minutes before, she'd been lying just like this, enjoying the familiar, secret nearness of Julia's limbs. She'd wanted to hold on to that moment, make a crystal bead of it. Now the bead felt shattered. For what was Julia to her, after all? She couldn't lean to her and kiss her. What could she do to say to the world that Julia was hers? What did she have to keep Julia faithful? She had only herself, her pressed meat thighs, her onion face. These thoughts raged through her like a darkness in her blood, while Julia read on, while the band played a final pop, 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 then put its instruments away, while the sun crept slowly over the sky and the shadows extended themselves across the yellow ground. But at last the miserable panic subsided. The darkness shrank, folded itself up. She said to herself, what an idiot you are. Julia loves you. It's only this beast in you she hates, this ridiculous monster. She moved her wrist again so that it just touched Julia's thigh. Julia kept still for a moment, then moved her own wrist to meet it. She put down her book and propped herself up. She took up an apple and a knife. She peeled the apple in one long strip, then cut the fruit into quarters and handed two of them to Helen. They ate together, watching the running about of dogs and children as they had before. Then they caught each other's gaze. Julia said, with a hint of coolness still, all over now? Helen coloured. Yes, Julia. Julia smiled. When she'd finished eating the apple, she lay back down and picked up her book again, and Helen watched her as she read. Her eyes were moving from word to word, but apart from that, her face was still, closed, blemishless as wax.
Thanks for reading that, Sarah.
Pleasure.
For Between the Covers, this is Jim Schumach. My guest today, novelist Sarah Waters. Her current work, The Night Watch, has just been published by Riverhead Books. Thanks for stopping by and spending this time with us this morning, Sarah.
Yeah, thank you. It's a pleasure.
Don't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me. With anyone else but her. No, 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 not a single soul but me. No, 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 don't you sit under the apple tree. Home, 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 sweet home. Don't go walking down Lover's Lane with anyone else but me. With anyone else but her. No, 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 not a single soul but me. No, 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 don't you go walking down Lover's Lane.
And you've been listening to Frankie Machine from the film The Man with the Golden Arm, Elmer Bernstein and his orchestra. The time is 9:31. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Still to come this morning at 10 o'clock, environmental journalist Elizabeth Grossman discusses High-Tech Trash, her new book examining the dark side of where computers and other electronic equipment comes from and where they go when you're done with them. At 10:30 on stage and studio, hear about the experiences and contributions of Southeast Asian refugees who came to Portland after the U.S. withdrawal from Vietnam in 1975. And at 11 on Democracy Now!, listen to Brian Ross, chief investigative reporter at ABC News. He'll be talking about an ABC report that the government is now tracking phone calls made by journalists from the New York Times, Washington Post, and ABC News. Right now, we're going to hear an interview by Rabia Yemin. She spoke with Liz Pearl, longtime editor and publisher, about her book, Money, a Memoir, Women, Emotions, and Cash.